as my business has grown and it's at a considerable size now, surrounding yourself with people that are smarter than you in the areas that you are not smart in, I think that has been great advice, because you do get to a point, I think, when you're a business owner where you think you know everything arrogantly, and that's just not true. And so you don't know what you don't know. So if you can afford it, get the people to support you, because with a great team, you can do anything.
Welcome to the Dion Gugliotto podcast, where I interview business people who run or have sold businesses worth a few million dollars all the way through to billions of dollars. While most of my time is spent managing investment portfolios for people after they've had a successful exit, I've always been fascinated by the entire process and hearing the insights that successful entrepreneurs and business people have learned along their journey. At Fortress Family Office, we're an investment portfolio manager and we manage portfolios for high net worth families. If you'd like to know more about not only the way we approach investment markets, but our philosophy on life and business, feel free to subscribe to my weekly insights note. Go to www.fortressfamilyoffice.com and hit subscribe. In this episode, I interview Adrian Sester, founder of Flavor Makers Group. Flavor Makers is a food manufacturing business that develops products such as spices, baby food, curry sauces, and much more. Founded in 1992, Adrian has grown the business to now employ over 330 people and turn over more than $220 million per year. Throughout this episode, Adrian talks about the importance of taking action when others won't, as this strategy has helped get the group's products into Walmart in the US and other international markets. Furthermore, Adrian emphasizes the importance of balancing gut instinct versus data-driven decision-making when faced with business challenges. If you enjoyed this episode, feel free to share with family, friends, and leave a five-star review. Adrian, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.
You want to just give us a little bit of a background to your business you're running now, Flavor Makers? Just tell us a bit about that business.
Sure. My stories can go forever, Dion, so rein me in whenever you feel like it. I'm an Italian. I grew up in a family that were in business. My uncle and my father were business partners in the poultry industry in Victoria. I'm the youngest of five, and effectively I watched my parents lose everything at about 1976, I should say, at about the age of six.
Yep.
And then I saw my brother start again, effectively trying to win back what the family had lost. And he went bust as well. And I ended up starting my own business to help my father and mother, who mortgaged their home to help the brother that had lost everything, to get started again. And out of necessity, I started this business thinking, if I can help mum and dad pay, if my brother can't pay the mortgage, I've got mum and dad's back. That's sort of effectively how it began.
Yeah. I'm really interested to dig into that background and how that's shaped you as well. But what about Flavor Makers? What does it do? Tell us a bit about that.
Oh, Flavor Makers, we're a food manufacturing business. We are typically what's called in the ingredient industry. We have four or five core competencies. We blend herbs and spices right through to functional sports nutrition style products. We hot fill sauces. Typically, that means anything from a tomato ketchup through to a vindaloo in terms of culinary complexity. We do what's called cold filling as well. So that's typically anything from a salad dressing through to a whole egg mayonnaise. We do retorting. Retorting is the type of technology that's existed for over 150 years. It's actually not dissimilar to the way Italians make passata, Dion. It's the way that baby food is made. So we pretty much, in much of what we do, we're a turnkey provider to brands that want to start up or private label supermarket projects. We have an R&D team of about 16 chefs and food technologists that work primarily developing products all day long and trying to bring products to market. And we have our own brands as well. So we own brands that are in supermarkets. Probably the one that might be the most well known is a brand called Passage to India, which is in the Indian category in the supermarkets. It's in the pouch. We are the biggest Indian brand in Australia. We're sold in 24 countries around the world, including we're in Walmart's in the States, we're in Kroger's in the United States, Safeway, Albertsons. They're probably the three biggest chains. We're selling Passage to India and Passage to Asia products from Melbourne to Iceland, to the Scandinavian countries. So pretty crazy, really. And pretty much whatever I want to do when I wake up in the morning, if I come up with an idea, the beauty of having an R&D team and a culinary development team, I can sort of walk in and go, hey, got this idea. And it's a beautiful thing.
Is that where the products, what makes an Italian start making Indian flavors and things along those lines.
Yeah, well, it's a really interesting story, Dion. And effectively, I started making products for the retail butchery industry, poultry retail industry. And I set up a little trade show in Queensland with a distributor that we had up there. And I convinced him to put on a little trade show in his warehouse and invite his butcher customers along to meet some of his suppliers. And he backed me. And anyway, this story can go on forever. And it's very funny. But on the day that we were doing this trade show, I was loading in with my little van and loading into the warehouse, setting up my little stand. And as I was walking in, I noticed this rather portly Indian fellow who had a station wagon, and he was trying to get the little boxes, you know, the little boxes you see on shelf in the supermarkets these days. He couldn't reach them because they had gone up, you know, up close to the driver's end of the station wagon. And as I walked past him, I said, mate, can I help you? And he says, no, I'm fine. I do not need your help, you know. And I said, okay, keep walking. And then when I walked back, he'd left the station wagon open and he wasn't there. He'd obviously was carrying some stuff in. So I jumped into the back of his station wagon. I moved all the boxes down to the back so that when he got back, he could pick them all up really easily. And so anyway, I kept walking, got my next few boxes, walking past. And I see the guy walking up and he stops and he's scratching. He looks at me and he says, did you do this? I said, yes, I did. He said, I told you I did not need any help. That's how I met my father-in-law. He became my father-in-law.
Yeah, right. No, perfect story. I didn't see that twist coming in the end.
Neither did I. And so we were standing outside, and then he said, I'm very sorry. And I said, no, it's fine, mate. It's all good. And he said, look, I'd love you to come over and try my Indian food. And I said, well, only if you come over and try my tandoori spice. And he says, what are you doing tandoori? I said, yeah, I've got a tandoori spice. I'd love you to try it, but I'll come over. And I went over to try his products, and they were sensational. They were one of the things as a kid, I really prided myself on. I really loved going to foreign restaurants to try other cuisines. And when I tasted his Indian, I was transported to a restaurant, honestly. And I thought, this stuff's good. And I remember tasting Pataks and Sharwoods when they first came to Australia. And those products were really good. They mean dumbed down a lot from those days. But I was really taken aback. And anyway, I got Chris to come over. He tried my tandoori spice and he was blown away. Couldn't believe that I basically worked with an Indian to develop that product. And anyway, he then came up to me, but later on he said, can I meet you tomorrow? I said, I'm flying out tonight, Chris. I said, please, is there anything I can do to convince you? So, in the end I stayed. We had a long chat. He was really struggling. His business, he put everything on the line to start this business that was called Chutney Mary. And Chutney Mary is the name in the old English, colonial days of India. If you were a white man that married an Indian, she was called a Chutney Mary. Anyway, he basically said, look, I'm just about to lose everything. Is there anything, would you be interested in looking at my business? Long story short, we bought the business. I rang him up. I remember thinking it could be the biggest mistake of my life, getting into retail products or supermarkets. But I rang him on the 24th of December because I knew he'd be worried. We'd been negotiating, we'd been talking, and I let him know that we were going to do it. But I said, I was interested in buying the business. And I said to him, but Chris, if you're invested into the branding and the name of the, I don't want to take that away from you, but we've got to change it. He says, Vader, no problem. What are you thinking? And I said, I think Passage to India. And he said, oh, I love it. And I said, because at that time, Pataks were trying to move into Thai food and into Chinese food, and it just didn't work for Pataks because clearly an Indian brand. And Sharwoods were also doing it. So I thought, hey, this is we've got more legs here than just Indian, And so it came up with the idea of Passage to India, which is a famous book and a movie, actually, thinking that we could do Passage to Vietnam, Passage to Italy or Passage to Indonesia. And that's sort of what we did. But now we've changed it a little. Passage to India, Passage to Asia, and that portfolio of brands also owns a brand called Street Kitchen. Yeah, that's the story. Oh, and then, of course, I met his daughter about 10 years later. Sorry, I should add this bit because it's my wife.
No, that's important. This is
it is very important. And Chris not only became my business partner, but became a father-in-law. Crazy story.
Yeah. And how many years ago was that?
16, 17 years ago. Yeah,
okay. And in terms of the business now, you've got these multiple brands. What? How many people are in that in the business by way of scale? Just to give us some perspective. What sort of?
There's 330 people employed. We have an office in Sydney in Macquarie Park. We have a small office on the Gold Coast. We have a small office in New Zealand now actually as well.
I was going to say, in terms of like revenues and things like that, is that something you can share with us?
Our group turnover is around 220 million. We're about, 10 to 12% growth a year. We're a complex business, though.
Yeah. And as you've grown the business, did you take on private investors and those types of things?
No, we've never. Well, we have some bank debt these days, but really, pretty much until, I guess the answer, the way that I would explain this is having seen my parents go broke once and then my brother go broke, I really resisted, borrowing money from any source, frankly. To me, it was like, I've got to make this work. And if it doesn't work I've got to make this work with my money. And if it doesn't work with my money, then it's, probably I shouldn't be doing it, frankly.
Yeah, okay. So you wanted to do it on your terms?
Yeah, basically.
I respect that. And I was curious to see, because I had listened to another podcast that you'd been on a few years ago where you were talking about the trials and tribulations of your family and sort of losing the business once in the poultry game, I think it was.
That's right.
And then your brother, like you just explained, and later on. What does that do to your mindset as you're trying to grow, but then as you progress as well?
You don't take anything for granted. I think when my memories growing up at primary school was sort of silly thing that you remember, but having great runners,
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden I'm wearing Dunlop volleys. I think, you just can't take anything for granted because the reality is things can change real quick and don't overextend yourself. And I think in both instances in my family, that basically happened. Now, mind you, the stories behind what happened to both my brother and my mother, my father and his uncle, and his brother and brother, are stories of that are deeper rooted than just borrowing too much money. There's other things at hand there that within the poultry industry that effectively colluded to get rid of us, frankly, because we were growing too big. But yeah, but I think when you've grown up in a family that's been in business and all you talk around dinner table is business, it's a natural progression to move into having a business yourself, I think. I don't think you have the same fears. It's a bit like, I guess, if you're born into a family of accountants, you might become an accountant. When you're sitting around a dinner table and business is spoken all the time, it just feels second nature. That certainly wasn't afraid of starting a business, which is a good thing, I think.
I mean, I find that really interesting, that how that influences people, because I know my dad had a similar situation where he was a young kid at school. His dad went broke back in the day. Mm. And he went from suddenly being at the local Catholic primary school to being taken out of there and put into the local state school. They were on 20 acres on a tomato garden, and then they were in the state house. And that impacted him greatly in terms of the way he built his business and didn't want to take on debt and made him much more conservative than he otherwise might have been. But there's pros and cons to that. But it's really influenced his mindset, and I imagine it influences anyone's mindset because it's a significant life event.
Absolutely, and just like you said about your father maybe taking a more conservative route, I absolutely did with not wanting to borrow money or not wanting to get investors in. I had some opportunities early, but I wanted to be in control of my own destiny, Dion. I think that was probably a big part of it as well. This was my thing, and I wanted to make sure that I didn't lose control of it, I guess. And so I persevered for a lot longer, and I was very lucky. I was able to stay at my parents' house, being Italian, didn't have to pay board, and they supported me somewhat, through that period, lucky.
And you've also got other businesses. I've read Prosecco and cider. Is this still the case?
Yes, it is. Yes. I'm a bit like that. The old Bugs Bunny cartoon, the big dog and the small dog. Dog, and the little dog says, hey, what do you want to do today? And the big dog says, shut up. I'm the little dog.
Yeah, right.
I'm very optimistic by nature. I loved the thrill of, thrill is not the right word. I love having a go. The Prosecco thing is a really funny story. My two uncles came to Australia with my mother, and they started a construction business called Camillo Brothers in Melbourne. And in 1969, they sold it to their cousin, Baffy, and it became Clemmer Camillo, and now it's just Clemmer. But those two brothers went back to Italy. One started a kiwi fruit plantation in the home, you know, town of where they grew up. The other uncle started a hotel in Rome called the Boomerang, which I think is genius because you come back, right? That's a whole other story.
Got the Australian roots to it as well.
Yeah, exactly. But Uncle Tachizio, he started Kiwi Fruit, and he was my favorite uncle growing up. And I was lucky because I got to go back to Italy a number of times. I speak it fluently. And one day I was sitting there with my uncle, and I could see this thing going on in that area. It was, you know, Prosecco. And Prosecco, as a kid growing up in Italy, you know, when I was there, it was like a still white wine that everyone drank. It was table wine. And, you know, in a carafe, you know, that sort of thing. And then it just went crazy. Now, my uncle had his two sons running the kiwi fruit plantation and the nursery. And I said to my uncle, you sent your kids to study viticulture. You're in the heart of the Prosecco region. You've got land. What are you doing? And he's like, Adriano, I made a big mistake leaving Australia. I thought I was a big man coming home full of, you know, my pockets full of cash. I wanted to show off. But it was the biggest mistake I ever made. I should never have left Australia. He said, now I'm too old. I don't want to, you know, it's too old to change, you know. I said, yeah, but Zio, you've got, you know, your thoughts. They know how to do it. You know, anyway, sadly, my uncle passed away and I got a phone call from my cousin, Adrian, ironically. And he said, you know, you're right. We should have done this ages ago. And he said, do you think you can help? And I said, look, sure, let's do it. But let's not get rid of all the kiwi. How about you, you know, do half the farm and let's get this thing rolling. And, you know, all I ask is that if any of the cousins or if we get this thing moving, if we can help employ more of our family over there, you know, that we do that. And yeah, that was sort of the journey. And it was funny though, 2 years into it, my cousin rings me and says, right, wine's nearly ready. What do you want me to send it? Jesus, Lord. I said, oh, you want me to sell it? Like, yeah. I don't know how to farm it, but I don't know how to sell it. So anyway, that turned into an importing business, a wine importing business in Australia as well, importing Italian wine. That's sort of the journeys that I've gone along the way. And look, you know, to finish this story off, the cider is an interesting quick little story. We arrived at the Prosecco party late, let's put it that way. The brand's already established. It was hard to break into the market. I mean, it's had a stellar run, Prosecco. And I was trying to think of ways of how to get our Prosecco in front of more people. And really, what could I do to open the door to restaurants and bars and caterers and all that sort of stuff. And I don't know why, but I started thinking about apple cider. And at that time, apple cider was having its sort of moment in the sun. And I rang my cousin up and I said, listen, I'm pretty sure making apple cider is not that dissimilar to making Prosecco, the way they do it. Mm-hmm. And he says, oh, I don't know. You know, could you look into it? Can we see if we can make apple cider? And he's like, why would you want to do that, Adrian? I said, because, mate, there's no Italian apple cider. No one makes it. But there is a million Italian restaurants. So if I got the one Italian apple cider, I can use that to open the door.
He's like, oh, yeah. Italians are always a choosy Italian product.
Exactly. So that's why we started making apple cider, even though my cousin thought I was mad. Actually, really crazy story. We, this year, sent the cider to an awards show in the UK. It's the UK Cider Awards, which is effectively the Academy Awards of cider globally. And we sort of need to get a bit more momentum with this thing. I said to my younger cousin now, enter it into the awards. I'm sure we'll win something. We won best sparkling cider in the world, 2023, which is ridiculous. Perfect. Considering
that's awesome.
Considering it was a byproduct almost of trying to get the Prosecco off and running. So great stuff. Yes. Love it.
That's great. What about your leadership in the business? What is your biggest strength? And I think some of that's coming across in some of these stories as well. But tell us what your biggest strength is as you perceive it.
Look, I'm very optimistic. I've always believed the best in people. I think that makes me a good people person. I'm a good listener. And, you know, to be honest, I played cricket in my life and I actually ended up being captain of a cricket team. I was a wicketkeeper and I was blessed with the opportunity to play seniors with a bunch of people who came from all different walks of life. And being the captain made me have to think about how I could get the best out of a bricklayer, out of a lawyer. And that taught me a great deal about leadership. And I think as a result of that, I've become a good leader. I wouldn't say that I'm textbook business leader, but I'm fairly likable, I think. And I think that helps you with people, you know?
Yeah. So personable, getting along with people and understanding people.
Listening to people, having empathy, being humble, I think is also a very important trait. In fact, my father used to say it to me all the time, you know, humility is the greatest virtue, you know, and I've really tried to live like that.
And what about in terms of weaknesses? What year did you start the business for the first time?
1992. So, you know, 31 years.
So over that journey, you've no doubt grown a lot, learned a lot. When you started, what was your biggest weakness? And what's your biggest weakness today, would you say?
I think my biggest weakness when I started was that one of the things that really drove it, I don't know if it's a weakness, but I look back on it now and I think it was a bit silly and a bit naive. I probably wanted to prove myself to, you know, brothers, siblings, cousins. You know, when the family went broke the first time, there was a pretty acrimonious split between my uncle and my father and the families. So there was a little bit of a chip on my shoulder, I think, wanting to do the right thing and get our family back on the, you know, to a degree. But and I think that was a weakness, frankly, but it was also a strength, you know?
I was going to say, why do you think that's a weakness?
I think because I was driven by ego and there wasn't the purest of thoughts, if that makes sense. I'd like to not think of, we've all got ego. I don't think that ego is a great thing in people generally. And I think that was one of the things that might have driven me, but I think it's a bit of a weakness now in retrospect, but that's the way I was thinking at that time in my life, if that makes sense. What's my weakness now? What I was saying earlier, I get very excited about projects and don't necessarily put together a business case. Do you know? Just have I like to roll the dice, and I've got a machine that can do that, right? So I love the creativity of what we do. I love it. Don't necessarily love all the other bits that go with it at times.
Yeah, but in terms of having that machine that can put an idea out. A lot of tech companies these days try and live by that philosophy where you iterate quickly and test things very quickly and fail fast, move on. It sounds like you've got the creative spark to come up with different ideas and also now the mechanisms to test that and see if you've got something that would work and you can either move on with it quickly and take it to the next level, or you can shut it down quickly as well. Is that right there?
Yeah, you can, but the product cycle is a lot longer than is realized. Dealing with supermarkets these days is very difficult. They want to grow private label. They're not interested in brands. So starting brands from the get-go is really difficult unless you've got something unique.
Is that only in Australia though, Adrian, where you've got sort of Coles and or is that across the world? That's their strategy.
It's across the world. And every time there's a crisis like there is right now, it has been in the last few years, private label grows because inflation goes up. It gives the supermarkets more reason to search for private label solutions because they can use that as leverage to put something in the market that's cheaper and to entice people that are tight with them any at that particular time to try that. It's very, very difficult these days to start a brand, but absolutely I can trial things and see what if they work quickly, but the actual result of whether it's going to work or not can take a year or 2 years or, you know, even if you do have the, it's definitely harder to do. Look, when we started with Passage to India, the supermarkets wanted a margin of 32-33%. These days, the minimum margin that a supermarket is asking for these days, and typically the way it starts is a new brand comes into the market and the supermarkets push them and say, well, we need a 60% margin. And that starts the cycle, right? Someone does it. And then all of a sudden that becomes the new level. Right now, you know, it's most supermarkets are working on a 55-60% margin. So that's difficult. That's really difficult. And at the same time, manufacturing has become more and more difficult and auditing and compliance levels are getting to a ridiculous level. The margins are getting squeezed. In fact, I didn't want to take it down this path necessarily, but I really fear for the manufacturing industry in Australia. What we have to compete against in this country versus imports from overseas, it makes life very, very, very difficult.
On a compliance level or a cost level of manufacturing or just everything?
On a cost level, you've got the highest level of our wages are incredible compared to the rest of the world. I mean, that in itself, I mean, a factory worker these days is, you know, with on costs over $30 an hour. Yeah, and you're competing with, I mean, India's the extreme example, but people are getting paid $3 US a day.
But it's still competition at the end of the day, isn't it, right?
Exactly. And from a compliance level, Dion, it's insanity now. You know, I often ask who's going to audit the auditors. You know, it's got to a point now where, you know, effectively our job is to make something, put it in a container and sell it to people and hopefully employ people and make a profit. But that is absolutely not what we do anymore. I mean, just in compliance, HR compliance, every employee of ours now has to do online courses, right? Is the word I'm looking for.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah.
These courses can take 6 to 8 hours. You've got to do, and you can't say, can you do that at home? It's got to be done during work hours. And these things are just taking away from what we should be doing. And that is making great products and selling them and hopefully turning a profit and employing people. It's at a point of madness. Yeah. It truly is.
It's funny because it's gone. That's happened in lots of industries, I think. I mean, the financial advice, investment industry has gone through its fair share of those sorts of things. But what it does do at the end of the day, and this is going to sound a little bit stupid, but it actually does take the fun out of it. In terms of if you love your job and you love what you do, it does take a lot of the enjoyment aspects out of it for people who are craftsmen or people who really like what they do. It does change that on a smaller level. Does that make sense? Like I said, that probably sounds a bit corny, but
it does
actually change things because you're emphasizing the wrong things and you're just jumping through hoops.
But beyond that, what you're saying is absolutely 100% true, and I can't stand it. But it's the reality of business now. So, I mean, it's also going to stop people. I see a lot of businesses for sale now. And when I talk to the owners, they're just fatigued. It's owning a business is not what it should be. It's all this other stuff they didn't even realize it was coming at them. And they, some of them aren't even educated enough to be able to manage that stuff. They've come from poorer countries, or it's just another world beyond it. Well, costs have got to go up because you've got to cover it, right? Forget about the government compliances and the regulatory compliances and the finance, you know, we get audited every year now because we're at a certain level of turnover. We have to get in an outside accounting firm to audit us. If you're making product for Woolworths, you're audited by Woolworths. If you're making product for Coles, you're audited by Coles. If you're making product for McDonald's, you're audited by McDonald's. You know, you think about that. Every single global chain or supermarket chain that we deal with has their own auditing system and quality system. And we have to apply, we have to
meet their standards type of thing across all.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You got on top of that halal certification, kosher certification, gluten-free. It's just got to a point of madness.
Yeah, no, I can appreciate that. Like I said, the financial services industry has gone through similar things. You had the ASIC come through and rightly take a few of the big banks to town on some of the things that they did. The flow-on effects through the industry to smaller groups was quite significant and actually forced a lot of advisors, probably good advisors, out of the industry because it became too onerous and it was something that and now they've gone the other way. There's not enough advisors out there to advise the people. Costs go up. The average person can't afford advice. It just becomes a vicious circle, right? Okay. What about in business? When you've gone through that, the years of the progress of growing the business, what would you reflect back on and say your best decision was and why?
Look, the best decisions that I've made, I think, have been believing in myself. I know that sounds ridiculous, but I've had some crazy ideas down along the way and things like sitting in my office and thinking, do you know what? I'm going to write to the CEO of Walmart, and I have, and it's worked.
Yeah, okay.
Things like that, I think, have been some of the best decisions I've made where I've just thought, why not? Why can't I get to that person? Because if I did, I'm sure I could tell him my story to give me a go. In fact, that's literally what happened with us getting into Walmart.
Yeah, do you want to just tell us a little bit about that? Because that takes me back to some of the best things I've read, which is, and I've written this in my weekly note I send out, One example was Steve Jobs writing to the boss of, was it IBM? I think it was. And asking, and he was like 13, and asking for access to some of their stuff. But he rang the CEO and he just looked him up in the white pages and rang his home number and he answered back in that day and said, yep, no worries, and gave him a job as a kid. And then the other one was Kobe Bryant. Ringing people to get their advice, whether it was an orchestra, the conductor of an orchestra to learn from him or whatever else it might be. And he just said, everyone can make that call, but no one does.
Yeah.
So you made that call, but nobody else made. So I'm really interested to hear how that went.
Yeah, I did. So the CEO of Walmart at the time was a guy called Greg Foran, who's a New Zealander who worked for Woolworths. And long story, but we had developed the flavor system, the Woolworths roast chicken. And at some point, I got asked to work in a store that put in a new oven. So I was working in the store trying to work out how these new ovens were working so that I could get the cook time right so that they could then roll out to all stores around the country. And basically worked in this store for about 3 weeks. And every morning at about 6 a.m., Greg Foran would walk the store. And one day the deli buyer said, "Oh, have you met Greg?" I said, "No." Invited Greg over and introduced me. And then Greg would come every morning and say hello to me. And then one day I said to him, "Greg, can I just give you something that I've witnessed?" "Yeah, sure. Everyone's walking around here with a coffee in their hand or a bottle of water. Why don't you put drink holders on the trolleys, you know?" "Bloody hell, that's a great idea." They started rolling out trolleys with drink holders. Anyway, that was my meeting with Greg. And it was intimidated by the fact this guy's second in charge of Woolies. He effectively got overlooked for the role at Woolies as being the CEO. And so he left.
Yep.
He ended up in Walmart China. And then he was the CEO and president of Walmart China. And then he ended up becoming the Walmart CEO in America. And I got one of those emails, industry email that said, "Oh, you know, Greg Foran's now the CEO of Walmart." I thought, wow, that's amazing. What an achievement. So I thought, you know, what's his email going to be? It's going to be gforum@walmart.com or greg.foran, you know. I tried them all. I wrote to him and I just said, "Hi, Greg, I don't know if you remember me working in the store in Monavale when I met you cooking chickens. Hey, you know, what an achievement. You're the CEO of Walmart." And I wrote, you know, "Woolworths lost his Walmart's gain. Never understood that, mate. Congratulations. Pretty cool." And that was it.
Yep.
And he wrote back to me within 15 minutes. And he said, "Thanks, Adrian. That's really kind of you." And that was sort of it, really. It was a really nice message to get back. And then I guess I sat there for a few months and I thought, do I, don't I, you know?
Yep.
I wrote him an email again and I said, "Greg, you know, I think I've got some stuff here that could work at Walmart. Is there any chance you could introduce me to someone?" And I wrote back again really quickly. He said, "Of course, Adrian, no problem." The email started coming, the phone started ringing. I started getting phone calls from the president of grocery, vice president of, you know, the freezer department. It was ridiculous. Health department. And they were all like, "Absolutely want to meet you. Please come." Because the boss had said, "Talk to this guy."
Yeah, yeah.
Crazy. Yeah. And that literally opened the door for us. What's the chances? Knowing how the retail market works in America, if I had not have done that, I would not be in Walmart today. There's no way in the world.
But there's a massive lesson there for everybody, right? That
absolutely.
It is so easy not to send that email. And even though you made the initial contact, it's so easy not to send the follow-up email and be like, but what are you sitting on that for at the end of the day, right? Like, send it.
Didn't want to use the friendship.
No, I understand. Everyone does that.
But no, it was great. It was one of the best things I ever did, for sure.
Yeah, that's awesome. What about in terms of challenges that you've had along the way? What are a couple of the biggest challenges you've had and how you overcame them?
Yeah, we've invested in a few things that have failed. That one in particular could have really, really, really hurt us. I think the key to being entrepreneurial is to not play, you know, when you want to play in another sandpit, make sure you're not spending, you know, you're not using too much money that you're going to jeopardize the mothership. And on one occasion, at least, we jeopardized the mothership and we lost, you know, $6 million at a time that it really hurt us. And I guess retrospectively, I listened to other people, which is not a bad thing. Of course, you should listen to people. My gut was telling me, this is wrong, Adrian. What you've built here is trying to develop great products. These are not great products. But I listened to other people. I took their advice. We did it. The business failed and it cost us a pretty penny. But there's another lesson in that. And that is that you've got to learn from those mistakes. And what you've got to learn from those mistakes is not to make the same mistake. They're all bits of the puzzle that you learn along the way, Fionn, I think, you know?
Yeah, 100%. What was the biggest lesson out of that one? It was in terms of listening to your gut when you know that something's not right, or what the quality of the product? Which one would you just say is a bigger lesson out of it?
Well, you know, quietly in my own head, trust yourself a bit more, definitely. Yeah. But outwardly, I think both of those two things combined, to be honest.
Yeah, okay.
But I've definitely become more of a little bit more pushy with what I think is the right thing to do, because I feel like, hey, at the end of the day, I've got 32 years experience in this thing, you know, I've learned something, and if I've got a hunch that something's coming and it's a good idea, then probably got a good idea, you know. So I definitely push that part of it. Certainly from that lesson, I trust myself more. But absolutely, I do not like to make products that I don't want to eat myself. I find that it doesn't make any sense.
Yep. No, makes complete sense to go with the stuff that you would eat yourself. What about best advice you've ever been given? along the way. Speaking of people giving you their views on things and listening to people, but what about the best advice?
It's been 32 years, so hard to remember some of the really early stuff. I remember one of the things that I got told that fired me up was that I was going to fail. And it was the stupid idea to get into this fast industry. That was great advice because that really probably ignited a bit more fire under my feet to prove everyone wrong. As my business has grown and you know, it's at a considerable size now, surrounding yourself with people that are smarter than you in the areas that you are not smart in, I think that has been great advice because you do get to a point, I think, when you're a business owner where you think you know everything, you know, arrogantly, and that's just not true. And so you don't know what you don't know. So if you can afford it, get the people to support you because with a great team, you can do anything.
Yeah, I like that. That's good advice. And it's not easy to do necessarily, especially in the early days when you're building something. But even like you say, as you've gone along and had some success as well, then it becomes you've got to detach yourself from that success and sort of come back and start with an open mind all the time. Because even though you've got that experience and what you're thinking is probably right, there's always blind spots, right? That you're just not going to be able to realize.
Look at how the world has changed from a marketing point of view in the last 20 years. I grew up with, you know, X equals 1 to 10, you know, in terms of computing and black screens with green writing. In terms of how the world has changed in regard to computing and in particular the way you market products, you know, online, social media, et cetera, if I cannot keep up with that, it's impossible. So yeah. You got to get the right people to help you through that. And you, if you think you know it all, you're wrong.
But things like being data-driven and things like that, Adrian, is that something that forms a part of what you guys do and analytics and that sort of, or is that in not the same for a business that's sort of more traditional like yours?
Dion, we absolutely are data-driven, but not to the point of obsession. We still, because I guess it's still a family-owned business and because I'm still at the helm, it's still a fair bit of gut feel. You know, we'll go with something that I think is going to work, but then we try to, I don't necessarily want to push that onto my team anymore. I will sit there and go, right, let's do a research document on this. Let's come back. Let's discuss it. Anybody got, if you don't believe in it, let's talk about it. The bit that I'm sort of getting at is that the business model that I started versus what we are in now in terms of, you know, 2023, so many things have changed in terms of business that you have to have good people around you that know those bits that you don't know to take you to that next level. And that's really important. And you've got to have a good relationship with these people.
Have you got an example of the sorts of changes that come to mind when you say that, Adrian?
Here's a simple one. Mac or Microsoft? Back in the early days, it was which one do you go with? And everyone was going Microsoft. I went Apple. And probably because at that time, I thought creatively it was a better machine than what I was seeing. That alone was a moment where you had to make a decision because the accounting platforms were being built for Microsoft. They weren't being built for an Apple platform. The obvious ones are online marketing, the role of the influencer now. And actually, is it influencers anymore? Because it gets to that point where you can't trust what you're seeing and that everyone knows that influencer is getting paid. But hey, for a good 10 years there, that was the model.
Because consumers are smart, right? Consumers are smart.
Of course. And they're being bombarded. There's so much being thrown at them. So then it's moved to micro-influencers. That seems to be the thing, but that's happening and changing so quickly. It's fluid. And if you're not on top of it, if you're not aware of it, you know, you can spend a lot of money in the wrong area and fail. I think there are many examples of how the world has changed and influenced the way you do business. Look at the people that you talk to on your podcast. In general, they're tech businesses. And a lot of those businesses, those models of business didn't exist 5 years ago in some cases, you know. And there's an example of how quickly it's changing. And they're the ones that are doing the disrupting because they're finding that niche that needs to be filled. And often you're talking to people that don't really have peers or competitors because they've come up with that little idea. But that's because the world's changed so much in the last, you know.
Yeah, some of that stuff's crazy. I mean, I like to get into the nuts and bolts with family businesses that have grown over decades. But you'll often find that there are tech businesses of equal size in the hundreds of millions of dollars that were started 5 years ago in cybersecurity or something like that. And it's incredible. They're not just raising money and look like they're going to be good, that they are generating serious revenue because they're solving a real problem that's out there. It's just really high tech.
And how quickly they develop value. I'm a traditional FMCG food manufacturer that owns brands. And I hear these stories of tech geniuses who come up with an idea that's just gone crazy. And you go, what am I doing wrong? good luck to them, you know.
You're doing some stuff really, really right, I think, there, Adrian. I think you're going along all right. What about business people that inspire you? Who are the sort of people that come to mind?
Thought about this question because I knew it was coming, because as I said, I had been listening to your podcast and I think it's a bloody great podcast. I don't really read books about business. I never have. I've never really been interested in what are the systems and procedures that got me to where I am today. I read the Art of War early on in my life, but I typically read biographies and I'm probably more interested in what makes that entrepreneur tick. What is different about him that made him so tenacious? I'm probably more interested in that. But overall, the people that impress me the most are those that get that balance right. You know, they're great at business. They're great mothers or fathers who do more than just worry about making money. I think they're the people that honestly impress me more than Elon Musk, or, you know, like, that's a bad example. He's a genius.
Yeah, no, he's impressive in terms of what he does, but in terms of that balance you're talking about, it's not quite there. I actually heard someone talking about something the other day, and they were using examples of Elon Musk and Warren Buffett, who both people that are top of their game, but they spend every waking minute doing what they do. Buffett's always reading about stocks and always thinking about stocks. He might be humble and have the same house he built 40 or 50 years ago, but his life and his relationships and all those sorts of things are not what you'd necessarily aspire to.
Musk's
the same, right? So they become so obsessive, and that's sometimes the case with the people who we consider in society to be the greats, you know, is they look like they got a great lifestyle, but actually it's at the expense of probably the quality of their relationships and all those sorts of things. So there's a balance, and I think you're quite right in saying that.
Well, I think the other thing is, you know, there are a lot of ruthless people out there too, you know, and I'm not attracted to anybody that's, you know, I have zero interest in hurting anybody, really. You know, and I if I've got to crawl over people to make money, I'm not getting out of bed. But, you know, like, that's just not what gets me excited at all. But it does excite people. There are people out there that are.
Oh, like mate, that, I've worked, you know, in finance for 25 years. Everyone in finance, or half the people in finance, is just like that, right? It's like, I don't know why. Who wants to live like that? Life too short.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Absolutely does not get me excited in the least. No. You know.
More to life than money. What about what's next for the business and for yourself over the next 5, 10 years, that sort of stuff? What are you thinking?
I don't suffer from a lack of ideas. There's probably 4 or 5 that I'm playing with right now. And again, I've got this machine which helps me be able to explore some of those creative ideas. I think, look, again, talking to the Italian background that you've got, I've got, I think there's a real opportunity to get products made in Italy, because that, you know, the story of the Made in Italy name is quite strong. And I think Italy's forgotten how important that is. I'm actually looking at doing a few more things in Italy and trying to drive the marketing concepts out of Italy back into, you know, outside of Italy to export markets. And, you know, I really want a connection with Italy because I love it. I think for our business, you know, going back to what I was saying earlier about, you know, the margins getting squeezed at both ends, whether it's the retail or whether it's government compliance and every other compliance, I think we've got to probably focus harder on becoming more vertically integrated. And that's going to be a focus of mine and the business in the next few years, that building of provenance. And I mean, we're quite lucky in Australia from a perception point of view, we're considered one of the cleanest, greenest countries in the world. And we need to take advantage of that perception. And I think to do that, we've got to start building bigger stories around provenance. Look, to give you an example, 63% of the certified organic land in the world is in Australia. We're sitting on the doorstep of Southeast Asia. They all want our products because they believe that the products are grown in better environments. We've got to find a way to tap into that. In fact, the government should be helping us, frankly, I think. But so I'm focused on, you know, trying to build a better story around Australian products. That's something that we're focused on. Yeah. And I think, yeah, effectively that, the, you know, the vertical integration and the fun stuff that I want to do over here with the Made in Italy stuff, that's sort of where we're heading.
Sounds awesome. I especially love the Made in Italy part. On a side note, I've been making my own limoncello at home. if you ever need a head of product over in Italy to look after some lemons or something like that, just let me know.
Oh, mate, I'll put you on the list. No worries. It'll be great. Limoncello, great product.
Good stuff. Adrian, thanks very much for your time, mate. We really appreciate it. It's been great.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed the show. If you did, we would really appreciate it if you would leave a 5-star review and share with family and friends. Thanks.